software meeting the hardware of robotics and these AI models, and our whole world can flip upside down, and our education can flip upside down, and what we need as a society could be flipped upside down here too. So
content moderation, testing, evaluation, verification. If I was to make big bets on what's important going forward, it's definitely evaluation and verification. Teachers need to be able to see under the hood to ensure that the content they are creating is fit for purpose for the classroom and understand where that might not be the case.
Just because we can doesn't mean we should. And all these tools that, and all the AI use that's being done in schools is done now without data. And there's been zero data to support anything.
Welcome everyone to the AMP211 podcast. We are honored. It is a double trouble today with Thomas Thompson IV, the CEO of EduAid, as well as Thomas Hummel, the Chief Product Officer and current middle school science teacher. It is an honor and pleasure to have you both here joining us today. How are you both doing today?
Doing well. Thank you for the invite. It's great to be here.
Thanks, Brett. Doing awesome.
My partner to the north, Rebecca Boltzma. How are you doing today, Rebecca?
I'm good. I just want to hear all about Thomas's new baby, actually.
Please, yeah. Start us off with some joy. Tell us everything.
Yeah, so technically, I'm on the longest break I've ever had from teaching right now on paternity leave. So my wife and I just had a baby at the beginning of October, so October 7th. And so I've been off now for about a month just being a dad and a little boy, healthy and happy and just getting absolutely no sleep. He's actually nocturnal, so my days are all flipped around, and it's just a total disaster in that front, but a beautiful disaster nonetheless. You know, thank you for asking. I mean, I appreciate that.
Parenthood, a beautiful disaster.
Thumbs it up.
Yeah, like I don't have my hair done. I didn't have time to do my hair or anything, so I got the skull cap on here. Probably haven't shaved in a few days, but you know, just running EduAid and trying to manage my own life in certain ways.
Well, first, really then, thank you. And our listeners, just to give some context here, and then we're going to turn over to our amazing guests. We didn't know that Thomas Hummel was on paternity leave, so all the more exciting. But I did have the chance to meet Thomas a few months back, and their story of him and Thomas Thompson IV was just so incredible that I said, we have to have them as guests on AMP211 because they're currently building AI solutions and iterating and refining them as current practitioners in the field. And you really can't ask for a much more authentic experience than that in the age of AI. So without further ado, I'm going to open up to either Thomas. You all take turns. The audience, maybe you want to introduce your name every time, but could you maybe tell us, like, you're talking across the hall, you're in real classrooms, and all of a sudden EduAid AI is formed. Can you kind of just share for everyone your journey, your why, and how that conversation grow into this amazing organization you co-founded and built together?
Yeah. So Thomas Hummel is the science teacher of the both of us. So, you know, he's plugged into a lot of online circles and whatnot. And it was around the time that GPT was about to be launched publicly. He starts playing around with the tool. He says, I asked it to create a lesson plan. It's pretty good. Could be better, but this is pretty good. It saved me some time. It was really fast. Like, this could be an interesting thing. So then we said, okay, it's not the ideal user interface for a teacher. It's not the ideal way for a teacher to interact with an AI tool. So we said, perhaps we could do something better that speaks directly to the teacher, that couches the AI within the classroom, that meets the teacher where they're at, where their skill level is at, and kind of speaks their language. And from there, started building EduAid. Us two and our other co-founder, Tyler, he's the engineer of the group.
Oftentimes, we don't have the luxury of having two guests, but would Thomas Hummel, is there anything else you'd want to add, or did he get that story pretty well?
Yeah, I mean, it really just started off from the premise that we were working in these Title I schools on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, and like the job of teaching, like when you're young, you have like this ambition about teaching and how this is going to be the greatest job ever and I'm going to change the world. But then you start to face the actual system of teaching. And while you are making a big difference in the lives of students, there is like the system that comes into play that is just insurmountable. And so we were seeing teacher turnover all the time. We were seeing teachers get hired without teacher certificates that we had to work with. And it was really hard to kind of pick up that slack as the professional teacher in the building. and still be positive and still have energy and still have a life outside of the classroom. And, you know, we set out to sort of solve these bigger issues in education, you know, bigger than just our classroom, whenever we tried to develop this product. And so, like Thomas said, we launched it with just us three, and there was like nothing else in the space. And what we found was that what we did really resonated with teachers, and it just caught on like wildfire. And our growth charts like really went like just off of the charts. And it was just affirmation that what we were doing needed to be refined and needed all of the attention that we possibly could do. Because the power of AI, you know, the right way in education, we see as really powerful, but we also see like there's also a negative side that can come about from that too. And so, you know, we're just trying to do the best that we can by the teachers that we are trying to help on the mission that we set out to do.
So, for people who are unfamiliar with EduAid, tell us what you do. What does your company do? What do you build? How do you support teachers?
In short, it's a workspace for teachers to do all of the work of instructional planning, from the creation of materials, assets, resources that you'd use in the classroom, to kind of ideating, thinking about what you might do in the classroom, exploring different methods and techniques of instruction. Just to give you a concrete example, you know, retrieval practice is a very effective tool in the teacher's toolbox. However, you know, generating and coming up with a number of different retrieval questions can be time consuming, especially if you're trying to create some variety for different student needs and all of these types of things. Generative AI is terrific at creating just an arbitrary number of retrieval practice questions if you can, you know, get the prompting right for the retrieval piece. So a teacher could, say, create a short answer worksheet with minimally differentiated question types, all in that retrieval realm. Or you could, say, create a worked example or an elaborated analogy or a direct instruction script or a jigsaw activity or a review game or graphic organizers. And I could just keep going because there's about 125 different educational assets and resources in EduAid that the teacher can create. Loads it into a text editor, and you have full control over it. You can, you know, add different types of questions. Then you could differentiate the materials. We have a bunch of one-click tools to do differentiation. So you could think maybe uploading a material you already have created, and then maybe being able to translate that, chunk the text into smaller sections, insert check for understanding questions, right? So it's really a set of limitless possibilities for a teacher to play in this kind of sandbox that we've provided them. We don't really tell them what to do or how to do it. We just provide a bunch of pieces. The teachers can make what they want, take what they need, and discard the rest if it's not something that they could use in the classroom or need that day.
Now, part of what I do and what I talk about in my regular life has to do with, responsible AI and AI ethics. How have you made sure that the tools that you're building are ethical, are safe, are responsible to be in schools and for teachers to use?
Rigorous testing and research. So, to that end, we've partnered with the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, CZI, and we're beta testing their evaluator tools and co-designing those with that team. They're a terrific team over there. And this gives us access to say, if you create something that you state is for a second grader, is this actually at a second grade reading level in terms of sentence structure, vocabulary choice? Is it appropriate for the grade? So am I going beyond, say, content that would be appropriate for that age level? If I want to scaffold up to that, it'll provide options for scaffolding. So we're actually going to make these some of these evaluator tools publicly available on our side so teachers can get transparency into the outputs themselves. But we do a lot of testing internally for that. Then, of course, there is the endpoints for content moderation. That way, we're not, say, bringing in student personally identifiable information to the system or providing responses for unethical queries around. We moderate on nine different topic areas, and I'm hard pressed to call them all off of top of mind, but things around, you know, bias, violence, sexual topics, things like this. We moderate for all of those as well. So, content moderation, testing, evaluation, verification. If I was to make big bets on what's important going forward, it's definitely evaluation and verification. Teachers need to be able to see under the hood to ensure that the content they are creating is fit for purpose for the classroom and understand where that might not be the case. So, again, new update for EduAid that's coming out very soon. You'll have those evaluation tools publicly available, but we use them internally right now.
Yeah, I would, Rebecca, I would say like zooming out too, like from a company standpoint, what we do to like ensure, ethical practices and like ensure that AI is safe is we've actually just kind of tried to make those decisions along the way as we were building this. Like we could have done a student facing side of this. We chose not to because of those concerns. We could have, taken a different route. But what we do is we just keep getting feedback from teachers and whether or not that they, the professional educators, think that it is appropriate or not is like one of the best ways for us to ensure what we're doing is that line. It's like nobody can really vet this material better than a professional teacher. And we've kind of tried to stay within that framework of what we were building too. Like we don't take any student data. We don't allow students to use this thing. And so, despite that probably hurting our growth numbers or our metrics or time on our platform or any kind of metrics that any other business has to return to somebody, we don't have to do that. And so, that is how we are trying to do what's best by our user base.
Yeah, no, I love that. That's part of the things I ask about and that I look for in particular. So I'm a fan so far.
For our listeners out there, but also bigger picture. So, right, we're talking about EduAid, but also just in general, when you partner with either individual teachers or schools and or districts, first, we'd love to hear how do you partner with these different users? And right now, with AI evolving so quickly, what are the most important guardrails that you think like schools need to have in place for tools to be successful and ultimately to either make education educators more empowered, students more engaged, increase student outcomes, et cetera. What are some of the like core tenets that you want to make sure you see in policies moving forward and guardrails?
It's a great question. So I would say probably some of the most important pillars are one that you have an AI policy, like is the first hurdle. That sounds obvious, but there are quite a few schools that have been slow to adopt some form
My
of
school
AI
doesn't have
policy.
an AI policy.
Yeah, okay. So there's one example right there. A, you need to adopt some policy. There's great resources out there. Lance Eaton, he has a terrific Substack where he collates, I think it's like 125 different AI syllabus policies all in one database so teachers can see a sampling of different types. So definitely do the research and explore because what I call out as maybe the most important may not be so important to other schools, other districts, but there are some baseline things we should all get right. One is what is happening to the teacher and students' data that is being entered into the systems and being returned to them, right? That's the first one. What's the data privacy agreement between you and the company? Because a company like EduAid or Magic School or DFIT or Brisk or School AI or any number of these AI tools for teachers don't have an internal AI model that the company itself owns. They are making API calls to foundation models. How are those relationships governed? What are the data protection practices and agreements between these companies and these AI providers and vendors. So there's a vast interplay where data is floating from many different organizations between other organizations. So how are those relationships governed? Which relationships are there? Which sub-processors are there? You need insight and transparency into how the company is using your data for some AI response. You may not even know which AI model is being used. So that's another question. You need to be explicit about which models are being used for which purposes and whether or not there are content moderation endpoints and guardrails in place. That's probably the first pillar. And then the other is acceptable use policies for teachers and for students. You won't know if you're breaking the rules unless they are very clear to you. So when is it okay for a student to use an AI model? Is it ever okay for a student to use an AI model for what purposes, et cetera? And same for an educator. How can they use this in their work? Which use cases are okay? Here's an example. Is it okay for a teacher to use an AI to generate practice problems for a review for an upcoming assessment? Most people would probably say, yeah, as long as they're vetting the questions, ensuring that they're factually accurate. Is it okay for a teacher to use an AI to respond to an email from a parent? Now we might have some divided opinions. If the parent is talking to the teacher, perhaps they want a response directly from that teacher, not from an AI model. Are you sharing the parent's name and email with the AI when you're copying over the message? You probably shouldn't do that. You definitely shouldn't do that. I should reframe. Okay, third use case. Should an AI be used to grade your student's assignment and then be kind of the grade that will reflect maybe promotion through the class or to another grade? It could be grades hold a lot of power over student promotion in school. So, final use case, should an AI be used to write an IEP plan where you have a significant amount of personally identifiable information, medical records, etc.? So there's numerous types of use cases in a teacher's job and in different types of teaching positions. So being a special educator versus the general educator in a classroom, teaching high school versus teaching elementary school. Like there's so many different populations of teachers that might interact with generative AIs in different ways. So you need a clear, acceptable use policy that addresses these types of use cases for the educator and again, for the student. So data privacy and acceptable use are probably the two first pillars. And I've droned on long enough.
You're saying all the things that I like to hear personally. So, what is the interplay then between your technology and what you do and, let's say, a school's AI policy? Where do those intersect?
Now, that might very well intersect one in the procurement process itself when they're looking at AI tools and investigating, this is our AI policy. Does your tool fall within these parameters? We've had a few schools that have reached out with inquiries about a school level partnership, and they would lay out clearly, like, we're looking for a tool that does this, this, and this. And here's our acceptable use policy. Does your tool like adhere to these following things? And of course, you need to read it. And if you say you do, you damn well better actually do it. And then, the second half is sometimes it's reflected in their DPA, their data privacy agreement. A lot of schools, however, are using DPAs that were clearly made before generative AI technologies were released. So they don't really have carve-outs about specific areas that. Here's an example. So a DPA policy around teacher identifiable information, right? So is then, say, the creation of a multiple choice tests that will be used in the classroom. Does this have any kind of that information? Is it addressed here? How does that fall under your policy? Because it technically is classwork, but it's not, say, student performed classwork. It doesn't have their name on it or something like this. So there's a lot of areas where some more clarity on how this DPA then will interact with an AI provider. It's not so clear in some cases. My example wasn't great, but you get the idea.
We interviewed a number of students recently, and it's like they're the amount of anxiety they're facing, and you're seeing this firsthand where they're like, so do I use AI here? Like, it is helping me learn. I'm not cheating, but am I cheating? And like all of those questions that are going on. So, like, one, how do you guide students? So, guidance. And then two, how do you protect them from the things they shouldn't be engaging with on AI for a number of reasons? So, literally, that, what's the ideal guidance and guardrails that you're seeing in the classroom? And then, obviously, as a founder of an education organization.
Yeah, so the my favorite thing that I've seen is this continuum out of North Carolina that each kind of individual assignment will have a score that a teacher should look over it, just like they would a grading scale, like how they would grade certain aspects of it. But you could start to assign different assignments the amount of AI that is acceptable. So like sort of an acceptable use policy on certain things. As far as I think that that's sort of where we should be going is like, right, there's sort of the world where you have to bridge the gap between the old school of education and the new school. And I think just being transparent in each individual assignment and taking it assignment by assignment is probably the best way to go about it and the most fair way to go about it for students. Like, if I tell a student, you know, this is going to be graded, I tell them that before I give them the assignment. That's just fair, right? And so I think the same thing should probably be true with AI use. Like, oh, okay, well, you can use a certain amount of this, or no, you can't use any of it on this assignment. And I think that that's the only you should have a clear guidance in that regard. For me personally, as a middle school teacher, I don't even really like my students are too young to be interacting with the foundational models under my supervision in my classroom. So I don't really have like I don't really see opportunity for me to be doing that with 12-year-olds and 13-year-olds. Like, I don't want to play loco parentes and say, hey, get on Chat GPT, here's an account. Like, you can use a certain amount of AI. Like, I just don't, I that's not how I'm operating it in my own personal classroom. So I hope that answered your question.
A great answer. I spent some time this morning reading a new report that Google put out about AI and learning and education in the last few days. And I just want to zoom out for a bit and just chat a little bit about what your predictions are, how you see AI, the big loose term, like in general, changing the way kids learn, teachers teach. What do you think the future looks like in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years in the classroom?
I'm usually quite hesitant to make any predictions because they have a habit of making me look foolish as time goes on. But the nice thing about this particular question is that while the technologies will evolve very quickly, the way the human brain operates has taken many, many years of evolution over time to get to where we're at. So I think the most helpful place to start is stripping away all the technology and asking a basic question, how do humans actually learn? If you start there, there are some practices, techniques, methods that teachers can employ to create conditions in which learning is more likely to take place. There's never like a surefire thing. Education is a game of probabilities. You're trying to create the most optimal conditions in which learning may most likely take place for particular students. So this rises around the interplay between retrieval, spacing, and interleaving of practice. Really, what it comes down to is deliberate practice over time with different problem types interleaved throughout. That's ultimately what I think the killer application for AI in education would be, and how to optimally go about this dance between the three. What types of retrieval questions to ask, when to ask them over time. Like many teachers might do reviews for a few weeks or cram a bunch of review right before a test, which is not really an effective practice if you are consistently referring to prior knowledge and making the prior knowledge that's requisite for the to be learned material very clear, and you're relating between the two and you're drawing analogies to experience. All of these things, generative AI might have some role in creating those analogies, those examples, the non-examples, the retrieval questions, the spacing calendar, when to interleave materials. But it really just goes back to those were effective practices long before there was generative AI. So can it in some way amplify a teacher's ability to implement those practices? Now, the unique problem that it brings about that we're going to have to solve for is cognitive offloading in novice learners. That's the biggest problem. Cognitive offloading, not only for novice learners in terms of the students, but novice teachers as well, who are maybe offloading educational practice to the AI and not forming like a firm competency with how teaching actually works and when and why they're using certain methods in the classroom. Same for students, right? If your AI tutor just gives you the answer after two IDKs, then it's probably not a great AI tutor. Again, it's forming shallow fluency, hollow understanding. Students aren't really mastering the content in any meaningful way, forming memory traces, any of this stuff that we need that actually contributes to learning. So strip away the technology. How does learning work? Once you answer that question, look at how the technology is then interacting with those processes. If it's amplifying processes that are most likely to create the conditions for solid, durable learning, then all power to it. And if it's undermining those conditions, then we should be concerned and figure out a way to mitigate that. So, cognitive offloading and effective learning sciences-based practice, some balance of those two is going to be the dance we need to do over the next couple of years. Relationships clearly relate to engagement and motivation with the student, and the teacher has to do this. And engagement and motivation are like prerequisites. If a student is totally disengaged because there's no buy-in, because they have a poor relationship with the teacher, which can actively undermine learning, that's a negative externality and a negative direction. What role does AI play in those relationships? My bet would be that AI can free up the teacher's time from just all of that paperwork and the piece of planning, all of that quality instruction, such that they might be able to better focus on the needs of the students directly in front of them. Instead of saying, let's say a student is falling behind, starting to get disheartened, maybe there's behavioral outbursts because of this, right? The student feels overwhelmed. They enter class, they feel frustrated. Maybe this goes on for a while. The teacher didn't catch it. The student associates frustration with this class and they form a negative opinion of the teacher, and all of these things start to occur. Building out materials that would reach that student where they're at is a tax on the teacher's time without a generative AI tool. With generative AI, they might be able to say, okay, here's the objective. Here is the material. The student struggled at this point. I need to create problems and scaffolding to help the student reach this. The teacher comes to class prepared with those materials, can then address that student where they're at, work through those frustrations. Because again, the teacher doesn't come in having went, oh my gosh, I was here until 9 p.m. last night creating all of these materials. I didn't get home until late. This triggered an argument with my significant other or something like this, and the teacher comes in with personal problems themselves and they're not their best self. So some combination of those. We recently did a pilot program with Teach for America, and that was actually one of the pieces of feedback that we got from some of those educators, which is I was able to enter the classroom feeling more energized because I felt more prepared because I had, multiple pieces of content differentiated for different student populations and needs. And I was able to go in and, have something for that student where they're at and then be able to address the concerns and misconceptions that they were building. And I think ultimately that would do a long way towards that relationship piece you were talking about.
Yeah, I think it's funny how, like, when you ask anybody about their learning experience or as a student, right, relationship with like a teacher or a mentor or a leader, like, that's like the number one thing. It's not some dumb test that you took. It's not even like the content that you learned. It's like, I was inspired by this person and they helped me fall in love with that. But that never gets taken into account whenever you have decision makers making decisions in school. So it's like the number one thing we value as an individual, but it's like not really taken into account all the time whenever you're making decisions for schools. Like, right. And it's kind of interesting. And so you asked the question about where do we see AI or where do I see AI going? Like, and when I zoom out, it's like, there is a world, like Thomas said, where AI allows teachers to have all this time and have better relationships with their students. And that is some of the feedback that we got. But there is also a world where, like, if these AI tutoring companies start to really have great data, I think it's a hard decision to make as a parent to send your kid to a traditional school if money isn't a factor. And I think that there's a world where AI could be the driving force of what changes what school could look like. I just think that our public schools are really fragile. I think that our workforce of teachers are really undervalued and underappreciated more than ever before. And they're uninspired because of that. And I don't think that, we don't have a lot of good people advocating for teachers and for the system that we have currently. So I don't know. Like, it's hard to say. Like, I listened to this podcast the other day with Brad Gerstner talking to Sam Altman, and he had said that anybody that predicts what's going to happen 3 years out is foolish. And that's like really hard to, it's really hard to hear for me, like, as an educator. It's like 3 years. Like, we could see the combination of software meeting the hardware of robotics and these AI models, and our whole world can flip upside down, and our education can flip upside down, and what we need as a society could be flipped upside down here too. So it's crazy. It's like we all value our relationships and we love our teachers and students and all that stuff, but when decisions get made, nobody that's never really brought into consideration.
No, I totally like what you bring up. And I think everyone's worried and talking about like it's going to change education. And then when I think about the parts of education that are broken, some of the things that you mentioned, I wonder how we can salvage the good parts, but leverage the power of AI, but not in a way that's damaging so that kids are forming unhealthy relationships with machines versus teachers, and you keep teachers engaged, like you mentioned. Like we're seeing, I'm from Canada, but we see the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's sort of the thesis behind our product, and sort of back to what Brett was getting at with guardrails is like, as soon as you start to believe that teachers are no longer the best guardrail for students and no longer the best expert, things are going to change very, very quickly. Like you take that power away from the professional educator to make decisions for students, right? You put that in the hands of AI, or you put that in the hands of other people or other like CEOs of different school systems, whatever those look like. I think you could see our education system change very quickly.
Yeah. So I'm kind of going to try to write this and kind of take what I've heard from each of you and ask, I want Thomas Hummel to answer this one as the current practitioner. So, Thomas Thompson did a great job of sharing, what is learning, right? Like his own theoretical beliefs and grounded in expertise. And Rebecca's really pushing on the ethics and the interplay between AI tools versus relationships. So Thomas Hummel, what you're talking about the lack of right now, the low morale due to lack of support teachers are feeling and underappreciation, when you are talking, forget about Eduate for a second, the power of AI. What's the best, like, you're in the teacher's lounge and you have a teacher, right? They don't have policy and you know they have the passion. They might just not feel supported right there. If you were to, like, you know, saddle up next to them and be like, hey, let me show you something really cool. Doesn't that, I'm not talking about, right? What is like the thing right now that you really see people light up around? And then simultaneously, like, what is the thing, not necessarily putting AI in the hands of a student, but what's the thing that translates when a teacher is using AI effectively that brings that joy of learning back to the student ultimately?
A way that, I would frame this, and Thomas and I have had a lot of discussions about it, but the thing that's the most powerful about AI right now in education, to me, as a teacher in the teacher's lounge or however you want to frame it, is that it lowers the cost of experimenting in the practice. And while it takes a lot of effort to redo your lessons from scratch, it doesn't take a lot of effort to use AI to tweak them and make them better in certain areas that I have already used. Like, that's what I use the AI for the most, is that this didn't work so great last year. I'm going to put a game in here in this aspect, or some questions in here in this aspect, or a small reading to add context in this aspect. It's not even there to replace the content or the curriculum, but it's there to enhance it. And when you're a passionate educator and you want to make your lessons better, like I know some teachers do, not all teachers, but if you truly do, AI is the best companion for that, because it's unlimited brainstorming and it's unlimited ideas, it's unlimited context that you want to add. And so it lowers the cost of experimenting. And in a practice of education, experimenting costs you a ton of time and a ton of effort. And a lot of teachers do the same lesson over and over again, even if it's not the best, because it just takes so much time to really do hammer out a high quality lesson.
We might dive deeper into that because I'd love to just kind of hear the actual moves you're making to like empower people specifically around that. And that might, so we might put a pin in that and come back to that in a little bit, but we are going to flip the script now. So Thomas Thompson the fourth, Thomas Hummel, you are now the co-host of the AMP to 11 podcast. Rebecca and I are on the hot seat. Please, each of you feel free to come up with one question that you'd like to ask us about what's happening in the world of AI and education.
Let me ask you this. You're all over the world, okay? Or you're at least all over the country giving all these speeches, and you're talking to educators all over the place. Do you feel like we are heading in the right direction with our implementation of the tools of AI and the use cases that you're seeing in schools? Or have we just bought into the latest hype cycle and in turn made wrong decisions? Like, that's how I feel. It's like, just because we can doesn't mean we should. And all these tools that and all the AI use that's being done in schools is done now without data. And there's been zero data to support anything. And so, whether or not we have made the right decisions have been made. Like, do you feel like people are regretting that those initial decisions, or do you think that we're going to try to like storm through with that?
Rebecca, if it's possible, do you want to go first? Only because you are actually doing this on an international level, and this is like your area of study, and also you're just really interesting, and I'd like to hear what you say first.
It's an interesting question. I think people move forward the best they can with the information they have at the time. I think obviously maybe the jurisdictions who just started with an outright ban probably like realize that this wouldn't be a fad. This would be something we needed to do. I don't think anyone has a choice but to plow forward. I think kind of you alluded to it. The biggest risk that I don't think we're talking about enough is this intersection of private business and ed tech tools of companies who are making millions of dollars off of underfunded education, plowing into schools, pulling those dollars out of education, and then making even more money when they harvest and sell the data from students and teachers. And that's something that really bothers me. And I think that's something that we need to take a breath and look at and get regulated as soon as possible. Because I like what you're doing because you are working directly with teachers. You're on the ground, you're giving back to the community that you serve and you're a part of it. I don't love the idea of that, how private industry has the ability now to fully impact and change our education system and take dollars away from it without necessarily giving anything back in return. So I would say that probably the biggest gap is that for me. I think not enough people know about it or talk about it or realizing what's happening on the back end with all of these tools that magically came out of nowhere and aren't necessarily grounded in best practice or ethical practice or even legal practice, or the fact we don't even have laws that exist that protect systems and people from things like this happening. I think that's a major gap. So I think that combined with the urgency that especially the school administrators I talk to feel about that they're behind, or you know, most of them care so much about preparing students for the future. They're all making decisions the best they can from a place of caring, based on limited information and based on whatever the fanciest tools told them.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that, like, I totally agree that it's from a place of caring, but it's from a place of desperation. And schools are not, right, people are not making decisions from a place of thriving. They're making a decision from surviving. And it's like, I hope that this, I'm going to throw this against the wall. I hope this sticks and I hope I can keep my job and I'm going to do anything to do that. And it's like, we see all kinds of turnover, right? This amount of superintendent turnover is at an all-time high. Like, you could go down the list of all kinds of people that are making decisions that when this AI fad came out, they really just left their morality or their ethics or their, I mean, I guess I don't want to say it like that, but there, it's just like the rush to do has been very scary for me to see.
Yeah. Making those decisions from a place of fear instead of having the time to actually measure and understand. And a lot of the people who are making those decisions, the superintendents, like, they're not trained procurement officers. They don't know the questions to ask. They don't understand this technology themselves. And so I think that's the biggest gap and risks that I'm seeing is just the sheer speed and desperation.
It's like they don't it's like what we are seeing is that people aren't even seeking information, though. They allow the information to come to them, and if you do that, it's you're never going to get a true story of the space and what's available and what's out there. It's like, right, there's all these meetings that superintendents go to that take $30,000 to go there and to sit down and talk to them. But it's almost like when we have this field of ed tech like that, it's like there's such a skewed perspective from the way I see it. It's like the conversation's not honest.
Yeah. Well, it's undue influence, right? From for-profit companies in a not-for-profit space, the social space.
Exactly. The intermixing of for-profit and non-profit is a dangerous precedent to set, and something that we're going to see how that plays out. I mean, OpenAI is started out as like a capped for-profit with a non-profit board, and now is for-profit and has a CEO is not consistently candid, and you know what kind of precedent does that set then as well? A little shaky. Yeah, the ideal is educational technology developed within the confines of the school itself, right? And among the teachers and among the staff and the students. There's a school district in Maine. They're doing something really interesting. You know, they bought the racks themselves. They're hosting their own local AI model. It's a collaborative project between the students, the staff, and the community to build it. It's something that they will own instead of paying out a subscription to a rent-seeking digital landlord. And, you know, they'll own the data. They'll own the hardware. They'll own the software. It's all in-house. I mean, that's the ideal version. Now, does every school have the bandwidth, time, and staff and budget to do all of this? Probably not. I think as Hummel was getting to, working from a place of desperation mixed with the rent-seeking incentives of like, you're missing out on this tool. You need to come on board and sign a licensing agreement with us. And, you know, all of these impulses, you've the institutional forces, just a lot of convergent factors that can definitely lead to negative outcomes for U.S. public education, which has been burned by educational technology before, overpromised and underdelivered. I mean, how many times? MOOCs, personalized learning. I mean, hearing that AI is going to be the thing that delivers personalized learning when we've been promised personalized learning since 1992 is pretty frustrating. Yeah,
just that term actually bothers me because
yeah, exactly.
It's still, like implies there's one linear way to get from here to there. And it will just meet you wherever you are on that one path, right? Like, and that there's only one way to get from here to there. It's just you might be behind or ahead, but you have to be on that one path.
Or collecting massive amounts of learning analytics for adaptive instructional platforms, which is a reactive. It's like from some arbitrary starting point that they picked. Yeah, I'm not a. It's. I work in educational technology now, but I generally dislike most educational technology. And I don't mean that as just like a selfish kind of business thing. Like, oh, we're the ones. No, Eduate has clear room for improvement. But the just the general field being so far removed from the classroom and from how learning and teaching actually works is clearly disheartening.
But it's good to hear that you guys are talking about doing it differently and doing it better, right? Like that to me is, you know, gives me hope because I think this is the way it should be and everything should be, right? People with pure motivations.
Unfortunately, though, Rebecca, it's like, our mission that we set out to do, these are the things that are getting in our way rather than actual product or actually like helping the teacher. Like, it's like there's a whole system of LMSs and pay to play and these conferences. I mean, it is really an ecosystem not really designed to have the best rise to the top all the time. And it's been very frustrating.
Oof, okay, that's a tough one. You all get such great opinions here. I'm going to be contrarian, not to be contrarian, like for sake of contrarianism, but like I'm gonna point out some of the things that I've noticed in the 5 years since I've been a school leader. So one, like I started education in 2005, now it's 2025. I venture to say probably no other time in American public education has 20 years really looked different and stayed the same, but like how much has authentically changed in what you're doing day to day as a teacher, student, administrator, parent. And I go to all these things you're talking about and I get time to talk to people like you all. And like right after this, I get to like reflect on what I'm listening to. So I know the place of privilege I'm saying all this from because I'm not making a lesson plan tonight. I'm like absorbing this. And I often think when I'm at conferences or events, like how are other people taking this information and actually applying it tomorrow to like the things they're responsible for, whether it's in the classroom or leading, I don't have to do that. So that's like the first thing. I think that is a luxury that allows me to have a certain perspective, but I also have empathy knowing like, I don't think I would have gone to those conferences. I would have stayed in my bubble. So first thing is like, you do need those intersections because I have seen people leave. Let's assume they're leaving with a good tool, but like, I've gone to really rural places where people have said we wouldn't even have known about this if we hadn't brought an AI summit to like rural Indiana or Pennsylvania or Ohio. So there's a strong validity for why we do that. I mean, I met Rebecca with her keynoting at an AI summit where people's minds were blown because she was showing them like real use cases for personal and professional use. And if that was in different hands, that could have had a really negative or different outcome. And luckily, there's people like Rebecca and people like the work you're leading. So that is important, like that access to innovation. But what you all have said, like the part that I hope we start to get right is one, let's put the focus on, again, like giving everyone concrete, practical implementation. Like if you're listen to the teachers who are telling you why students are struggling, listen to the students, their families, the leaders. And like, to me, that's an exceptional use of AI. Is listening and making an action plan once you collect evidence and wisdom. The part I still struggle with, and I don't have an answer to because there's not enough research on it, is like when I talk to students and they tell me the ways they're using it, I find it to be brilliant. They are saying it's helping them, right? They're not saying they're using it to cheat. They're saying it's helping them learn the way their brains work best. And there's no way a teacher could differentiate the instruction to that level. There's just not enough time. AI tools are helping with that. And I hope it continues to go that way from a pedagogical, like, this is good instructional practice based on what we know. This is a better way to continue to differentiate based on what we know. That, I think, is evident. Like, you can do that if applied well. The first thing is, how are you training them? Is the tool, the tool's the vehicle. So what are you training them on? Like, how are you making sure it aligns to good pedagogy? How are you getting that metacognition? To me, that's the biggest thing. Like, I found when I was a teacher, the hardest part to teach teachers when I was an instructional leader was like, students don't need to hear you talk about facts anymore at any point, really, since 2005. They need you to explain how you're thinking if you're the quote-unquote subject expert and you're leading students. And that was always the hardest shift for someone to be like, if you're going to talk, it has to be you explaining how or why, not a fact, and not for your sake of you speaking. I feel like AI is similar in that regard. If we can get people who understand how to use AI and leverage it to personalize and differentiate based on something that's valid, then that's the skill we need to be teaching people. And again, I don't know when the right time to put it in kids' hands are, when it's not. That's probably step two. But if teachers understood, like, there's a rationale for when to use it and how to use it and why to use it, I think that would help a lot with them starting to grapple with, okay, then when, if I'm learning this way, now maybe it's applicable for students in a certain scenario or use case. But those are all much bigger questions, and it's happening in very small pockets. So when I do see it, I'm so excited. But to answer, I think the final point is, I don't know how to scale that yet, but that's the power of yet.
I would say I agree with almost everything you said, but I'll be contrarian once more back, since it's a podcast, it's a place to be contrarian.
Double contrarian.
My one concern with out of everything you said, which again, broad agreement, is that in educational settings, learning experiences that minimize effort and increase the appearance of fluency and engagement and enthusiasm in the students leads those very students to inflate their own estimates of their learning. And there's a couple of papers on this. Carpenter 2020 on student misjudgment of their own learning is a great place to start. I worry that AI will create the appearance of fluency and engagement and enthusiasm, and they're not putting in that much effort and they feel like they're getting it. They're misjudging what they're actually learning, and they're not forming those durable memory traces and broad conceptual structures. The one piece of advice I'd give to any student is, the most important memory is still the one in your head. It's the one that relates experiences and connects those experiences to other ones and is very much more relational than what you get just looking something up or asking ChatGPT for it. And I do worry that any use of generative AI at the student level will in some way undermine that process of learning. Could be totally wrong, but I think a lot of the research so far points to that's a possibility that we should probably test more thoroughly as we use AI. Hopefully we do it before we would put it in front of students, but in the nature of reality is such that we'll probably have to do it while we're putting an AI in front of students. Not we, EduAid, we don't do that, but in general, as society, I mean.
I'm just wondering if maybe skills of the future involve like quickly synthesizing and adapting and the illusion of learning in some contexts. Maybe that is the skill, right? Like maybe how kids internalize and learn information in some contexts needs to or will need to be different in the future. And it will just need to be, how quickly can you skim and adapt and synthesize what you've learned in this job to make it good enough? At what point, maybe there'll be certain things that will really, really, really matter that matter now, but there may also be skills that we are dead set on teaching now, and we feel strongly that kids need to get these skills and AI can never help them with them. But it feels like the calculator conversation, however many years ago, you know, so that's just kind of another way to look at it too, right? I think that required skill set for successful humans in the future may look different than we think it does now, but there's no way to prepare for that. It's just part of an interesting conversation, which is why we invited you here.
And as a guest of the AMP 211 podcast right now in this hypothetical scenario, the contrarianism is going to continue. So I definitely agree with, like, I'm a big believer that frictionless learning isn't learning. So one is, you're right. Like, if you're going to teach students to go home and use AI, like the things I'm hearing them tell me, you're right. I don't know if they're actually learning. Their grades would validate that, meaning if they were asked to be assessed on a certain standard and skill and they're able to demonstrate that, and they're saying, This works how my brain works and allows me to take information that I know I'm going to be graded or assessed on and lets me, manipulate it in a way that helps me learn it. So like whether I'm a visual, they like visualizations or podcasts or relating it to Gossip Girl, whatever it is, like hearing students do that is very similar to how I learn. So I do internalize that as like, yes, like there were so many things I realized now I wish I had extra scaffolds and supports as a learner that I didn't have access to. So when kids take agency like that, that to me is a good use of AI. And they're still being accounted, like, did you learn this thing that the teacher said you're being assessed on? But to your point and what Rebecca just said, I think some of the skills that we never had to grapple with is like discernment, like when to use that tool, when to use your power, your brain versus an AI tool, when to use it in combination, when to use it and add a teammate. Like that, knowing when is going to be such a huge skill moving forward. And if you don't have some of those skills that you're referring to, yeah, you're definitely at a disadvantage if you don't know how to access that and apply it. And that is a fear I have of like everyone's going to become over-reliant on certain things. So definitely agree with you on that. That's only one question. How long was this interview?
I do want to point out, too, that all the, not once in this conversation have we talked about this big gap with parents, right? Like Brett was meeting with students this week and the kids were telling him about how their parents kind of use AI like Google and they don't have that discernment or know when to use it and how to use it. And so another big gap of support for students at home, you know, that, you know, is kind of being missed in the conversation that is an interesting opportunity to kind of bring them along for the ride so that they can model good learning and good behavior. We all can, right? For students, that's the goal.
That's actually the perfect segue to my question for both of you, which is that most commentary treats AI in education as this single kind of monolithic thing. But I'd like for us to spell out kind of a taxonomy. It won't be complete, but we can start. What are the maybe three most distinct use cases that deserve, you know, maybe entirely different strategies, right, of thinking or entirely different policies, right? A teacher use case might be different than students working with an AI tutor, which might be different than a AI that creates a learning analytics report that sends back to parents or something like this, just to create some crazy idea. But what do you think? What are the use cases? What's the areas that maybe get underrated, overrated? Where does this discussion not go or should it go? It's a pretty open question.
I have the interesting opportunity to sit as like both a teacher and a learner because I am doing like master's degree work in artificial intelligence ethics specifically. So I get to use it and experiment with it as a learning tool. And I find it highly valuable just as a learner and with my kids in college. Just to be able to, at the risk of using the word, we just agreed we don't like, but personalize how I consume information, right? So I was on the Google beta site today playing with some of their new AI tools that they're experimenting with, the lab. And one of them is kind of like Notebook LM, but it takes a research paper or a document and it will almost turn it into like kind of like a gossip session between friends. It's more of like a conversation you're listening in on than a podcast formal. And I've done that with my kids before, but interesting for connecting random ideas. But because I also did it with a teacher once too, who was teaching, you know, the Book of Exodus in a Catholic school, but her teenagers weren't into it. So she gave it an Outer Banks movie trailer and created something that was highly engaging. So I think that's probably one of the most interesting ways is to make learning interesting and unique and put it in a context that's actually engaging for an individual. Same with like Google Opal, which you can build these personalized apps instantly for every student if you want. I think those kind of very specific use cases that speak to the individual, I think those are the best possible things. If students could learn to leverage those tools to put this accounting information in basketball analogies, like I think that is super underutilized. For teachers and leaders in school, I think one of the best use cases I've found is like pressure testing. Like, here's my lesson. I want you, the AI tool I'm working with, to tell me 10 ways that a 10th grade student would think this is super boring, or tell me 10 ways that you would cheat on this assignment using AI. I think those kind of gap and pressure test opportunities are massive. I think like use it for that. Use it to hyper-personalize what you're doing and to find the gaps in what you might be missing. Those are the use cases that I default to over and over and over.
I've always, again, the hardest part to get for me as an educator when I had co-teachers or when I was coaching teachers or leading teachers was like, why? Like, why is this what you're doing? And there's no, I'm not saying that as like judgment. It's actually like, can you express to me like, why is this the best thing? And sometimes it's really hard to get them to that point. But one thing I hope to see now that there's AI is kind of what I heard Thomas say. I'm a huge proponent of individually by each assignment. Like, right, what's the skill you actually want them to use? AI doesn't exist. So you want them to learn how to do what? Okay, great. And let's all assume we're like, that's a good standard, like assuming all the standards are what we actually want kids to be learning and we can maintain a rigor. Now, the next question is, since we live in 2025, is should a student use AI for this assignment and in what specific way? And then how do you explain to a student, kind of going back to what we said before about not losing the intrinsic ways your brain works, is like, great, you need to still meet this benchmark and this bar and this level of rigor. So here's how AI could help you reach that level of rigor, to Rebecca's point, like, right, like have it work the way your brain works, right? At the end of the day, you still have to produce an outcome that, assumedly, if it's good, like, it's valuable. We want kids to be able to reach certain benchmarks and goals. But step one is, when is AI, a hindrance and when is it a helper? And actually have that conversation at the teacher level, because many teachers are great at giving explicit directions and instructions, verbal, nonverbal, on each sheet of paper. And yet, like, this feels like a bridge too far for many, but it's only because we actually haven't stopped and just been like, just unpack that. Like, what is it? What are you afraid of? Great. Let's name the fear. I'm afraid kids are going to write the essay. Okay. Now what? Like, what parts of the essay would actually be helpful? Do you want, like, when I had students who weren't always at grade or reading level in Title I schools, they could articulate history to me in such an interesting way. The gap was the writing. Okay. So, like, how are we going to bridge that gap? The thoughts are there. What's the skill? And I'm not pretending I'm a writing expert, but AI could help me help that kid figure out how to bridge that gap, because it could help me analyze what I have in front of me in a way I couldn't have done before. I wouldn't have the skill or the time. So, like, that's a good use case to me. And I hope that would be a good use of pedagogical, like, PD, is what's the skill? What's the way we can make AI a helper in this scenario when applicable? And, like, the end goal is you want them to be better at reaching these standards that, again, hopefully are the right ones. And if they are, then let's use it to help us. So that's my favorite use case right now. Then we'll figure out students, families, and the rest of it.
What's the biggest push, though, in education right now with AI?
That is the question.
Yeah.
What are we seeing as the push?
Yeah. What do you see as what's the rave? What do you think that's getting pushed in schools? Yeah. Yeah. I know what it is, but
I just think the vague message is, well, it depends on the school, but, like, you have to be using AI, but with, like, no real direction or benchmark or instructions along with it. Or, you know, you should be using it to plan your lessons. Like, it's very, very loose. I have seen very few schools who are like, here is specific requirements, which is probably better if you don't have specific requirements. But the big push is to kind of use it for lesson planning, differentiation, maybe to organize yourself personally. But it's very hard to do those things while staying within some of the guardrails that exist too. So I would say that there's not a lot of specific push or instruction to go along with it, or guidance to go along with it. What were you going to say? What are you seeing?
No, I was going to say, like, what do you think the goal? What is the goal of these AI companies? Like, what are they? What's the push? Like, what are they? What are
well,
they
we know
after?
What the goal for them is to be in all the schools and getting all the data and having the subscription model that then you're tied to, you know, almost forever, right? And then
for students.
For students, I think the goal is to, well, I don't know. You tell me. What are you seeing?
Yeah, no, that's where the money, I mean, per student models is the district paying model. And that's what companies are after, is time on chatbots, time spent on chatbots, student time spent on chatbots. Like, that's the metric that is being pushed. That's the goal.
I have some great research for you and some great people to follow, just because I do work in the UK, right? Like, it's very, very different over there than it is in the United States. But I don't think it has to be like that. Like, honestly, talking to you guys has given me so much more hope, just that there are people out there doing good things for the right reasons in school and giving these supports to teachers. And I'm really looking forward to amplifying your company and your message and what you're doing, because I think that's what we should be doing.
Yeah, I'm grateful for that, like, how fortuitous was that we reconnected. You know, you've reached out to me on LinkedIn and we've, like, circled, and I'm glad we had a chance to talk, because your story really did inspire me. And I can't imagine being a classroom teacher at any point in my life. You have a newborn, you're still teaching, when you return from maternity, and you're also trying to shape the face and the right reasons of how to bring AI to educators. So I want to commend both of you, Thomas Thompson IV and Thomas Hummel, and the work you're leading at EduAid. The last question we're going to go out on is this. We understand the amazing work you're leading. We appreciate you coming on. The last question we talk about is, if we're going to move education in the direction that you hope it goes, you need to also have other champions, right? We call it the Ocean's 11 question. Who's going to help you pull off the ultimate mission of, enhancing and improving education? Free-flowing, just who are some folks out there that you want to make sure others know about? You've named some great people, but who are some last folks that you might want to make sure get their flowers, as we close our show?
I'd like to shout out my guy, Jacob Cantor. Love that guy. Yeah, I know you know him. He's just been super kind to us. We have no business relationship with him, but he's just connected us with all kinds of people. Love that. We love our friends at CZI. They have been amazing with the Learning Commons. Everybody needs to go check that out. That's an incredible resource that we are going to bring to people as well. As far as other people, selfishly, AI tool that I use in my own classroom, CuriePod, if you haven't heard of them, they're amazing. Love that product. I think what they do, getting students feedback and still be engaging and leaving the teacher in power is the way that things should be going. So who else can I shout out? I don't know. That's it. We're bootstrapped, so we don't really have any real friends. We just have teachers. We just have a whole bunch of teachers that like our products. I shout them out, and I want to shout you guys out. Thank you for having us on. So appreciate that.
Talk to educators. That's the biggest takeaway. But you should also, if you're a teacher and you're listening to this, Daniel Willingham, and the book is Why Don't Students Like School? It's a terrific read. He is a terrific thinker. Read his articles, read his research. He's a cognitive scientist who really has just turned his lens to school. Terrific book, terrific person, still alive. So I'm sticking it to mostly alive people. Next, Paul Kirshner and Carl Hendrick. Carl Hendrick has a Substack called The Learning Dispatch. I wish I was getting kickbacks on this recommendation, but I'm not. But you should all go read it, right? It's terrific. The book is called How Teaching Happens. The sequel is called How Learning Happens, both written by the same authors. Carl Hendrick is terrific. Again, a couple other Substackers. Dylan Kane, he's a math teacher in Colorado. He's a Substack called 5-12-13, I believe. You should go read that. It's, again, terrific in the classroom, on the ground. And now for the dead people, Daniel Dennett, cognitive scientist, philosopher, very useful. John Dewey, go back, reconnect with the history that we all have sprung from. Mortimer J. Adler. All right, the Padilla proposal. It's a terrific idea for the future of schools back in the 80s. Great books program. The idea that there are great ideas, that there's a great conversation, that there's great books we should read is really important, especially with AI. And then that's it. I'll leave it there. Yeah, that's probably a good list. Mortimer J. Adler, John Dewey, Daniel Dennett, Paul Kirshner, Carl Hendrick, and Daniel Willingham.
This is why I brought him on board. There's no science, there's no ed nerd like Thomas Thompson.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Anything cool is to raise kids who are curious and thinking outside the box and trying to give back. So I think everybody should read all those books if it gives us even half a shot of raising good people who end up doing the great work that you two are doing. So thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Of course. Thank you so much for the invite. Thank you for the great questions.
Thomas, keep up doing the amazing work you're doing. Keep raising the next generation of curious learners. Keep educating them and keep providing educators with safe, effective tools in their classrooms. And on behalf of Rebecca and I just want to thank our audience for taking time to listen to the AMP 211 podcast. You all have a wonderful day, and we'll see you on our next episode.